I'm just gonna have a recording real quick, doing a mic check for us
Yeah.
as we're talking here. So,
Mic check. 212. When I come correct, I come with my crew. What? That was a rap that I just did.
Is that what that was?
That was just a little rap I just made up.
Freestyle rap.
That's a freestyle rap I just did.
I'm okay. I don't know what to say to that.
This is just a mic check, right?
It rhymed a little bit. No, this is going in the podcast. Actually, I'm starting with this. Welcome back, everyone, to episode 2 of the Dice Pirates. We're going to be having a discussion on gateway board games today. I'm Ian, your captain, joined by my quartermaster, Matt. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing great. I don't know what a quartermaster is, Ian, but I appreciate... Is that a bump in title from last week when I was... I was first mate last week. Did I get demoted?
It was really more of a side grade. See, here's a fun fact about pirates, actually. Pirates tended to have democratic elections to elect their leaders. And as such, they didn't have first mates, who were generally more of an appointed title. They were actually quartermasters. So if you're on a pirate ship, instead of a first mate, you'd have captain, then quartermaster.
So just to be clear, I'm still second in command. Is that what you're saying?
Still second in command.
I don't know if I agree with that, but also I do think that we need to open every episode with a pirate fact every week.
Ooh, I don't want to promise something I can't really fulfill.
No, I think we need to do that.
All right, but what have you been playing this week, Matt?
I've been playing several games, but I wanted to open up this week with a game that I've been playing with my kids, actually, because even though on our game night group we play a lot of heavy games, strategy games, role-playing stuff, family games are still a big part of the board game experience, and it's the way that most people are going to learn about board games is playing with their family. And so I picked up one that I really want to recommend to any parents out there, and that is Scooby-Doo Betrayal at House on the Hill Edition, or Betrayal at House on the Hill Scooby-Doo Edition, I should say. This is a surprisingly fun take on the Betrayal at the House on the Hill concept. And if you're not familiar with that, Betrayal is kind of a venerable board game that has been around a long time now, from Avalon Hill originally. I think Wizards of the Coast publishes it these days. And it's basically a B-movie in a box, a kind of haunted house adventure where you explore a haunted house. There's a twist ending where one of the players becomes a traitor, and everyone has to resolve a kind of spooky scenario, maybe involving zombies, space aliens, some kind of craziness. It's sort of, it's fun. It's good for a few laughs, but it's also sort of notoriously easy to game to be kind of broken and unbalanced. When it's good, it's great, and it can also be really kind of a slog. The Scooby-Doo version of the game streamlines the rules, changes the format just enough to make it a surprisingly fun family game, but also it almost kind of fixes a lot of the issues with Betrayal. It's a really cool take on it.
It definitely is one of those games that I really enjoy playing. I think that Betrayal at Baldur's Gate, which is another game made by the same people in the same universe, well, the same theme. Obviously, it's the D&D universe is what they focused on with Betrayal at Baldur's Gate. But when you play that game, it does do the same thing where it gets rid of a lot of the frustrations and a lot of the things that make the game end really fast, potentially.
It's really funny to me watching, I guess, Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast are kind of doing the same thing with the Betrayal license, as you see being done with, like, the Risk and Monopoly license, where there's all these themed versions around different IPs. So I wonder if we're just going to start seeing more and more takes on the Betrayal theme. But the and I was really interested to play the Baldur's Gate one. I still like to do that sometime. But picked up the Scooby-Doo one because I thought the kids would like it. And it's basically what you would expect. I mean, you are the Mystery Inc. crew. You're exploring the haunted house, very similar to the classic version of Betrayal, and trying to solve a mystery. And in the end, you pin the bad guy and unmask him. And somebody reads aloud that classic bit of dialogue. They would have got away with it too if it weren't for those dastardly kids, or for those darn kids. And it's really good. It has all the things that you expect from Betrayal. It's got traps and encounters. You make skill checks and rolls to get through it, so you're still introducing people to the kind of role-playing light action that you see in the Betrayal games, but it's just much easier to grasp. One of the smart things they do is you draw a scenario card at the start of the game. This is something different than the Betrayal out of the box. You draw a scenario card that kind of sets up the story, and it actually limits the number of random endings that you can get so that the ending actually makes sense. It actually tells a cohesive story. So if you draw an adventure card that says you're headed over to the house to explore mysterious lights in the sky, you will probably end up with an encounter that explains aliens, and it ties it together. It actually tells a cohesive story for the kids, and it was really neat. But you still have all these fun elements. You pick from one of the classic Scooby-Doo characters. They all have different powers. You have Scooby snacks that you pick up that let you reroll dice. And there's a lot of things that are in it to make it a little bit easier and less frustrating. You can't actually be knocked out and defeated from the game. You just lose a turn if your health or your stats fall to zero. But really fun, light take on the Betrayal formula. I think it's perfect for families. I think it's worth a look.
Yeah, that's a game I'd definitely be interested in playing at some point, because I like the Betrayal games. And, I mean, if what you're saying is true, like, if they do start doing more themed aspects, I wouldn't mind playing each one. Because while you can only change risks so much, Betrayal requires a certain theme behind it. So it actually plays into the theme, which I think is really neat.
Yeah, I think this is actually, I picked this game to kind of open up with you because I think it ties into our main topic today really well, which is gateway games. And I think the Betrayal games, I know you're going to talk a little bit probably about Betrayal later, but the Betrayal games I think are good games that kind of introduce people to, if you've never played a role-playing game before, if you've never done like dice combat or stat checks, these games kind of introduce it in a light, fun way. And this one's a good one to get kids involved in that type of gameplay.
Yeah, no, I love that. Love that.
What about you? What's a game that you've been playing?
So a game I've actually played a couple times in the last few weeks has been Above and Below. This is a game that I thoroughly enjoy. It basically is a choose your own adventure worker placement game, if I had to describe it. It is basically your standard worker placement games. You have a bunch of different options. You're trying to build buildings to get points. And the selling aspect of the game is that you can go adventuring with your workers. Now, when you go adventuring with your workers, you give a booklet that has 200 odd encounters, and you will never get the same one twice in one session. And you often don't get the same ones within three or four because there's so many. So the way that this game works is that you give that booklet to somebody, you roll a number, and based on that number, you go adventuring in there. They read a certain sting to you. You have to make a choice between one action or another. I may find somebody on the side of the road that needs help in a dangerous position. I can say, oh, I'm going to help them out, or I'm going to leave because it's too dangerous for me. And there is a certain aspect of like risk-taking, because you have to roll certain numbers to be able to save somebody. Some numbers might be high, some numbers might be low, but obviously it's a risk, you know, risk-reward situation. But it's very fun to actually have kind of a story aspect to a game that otherwise would just be a very bland worker placement game. And I've really been enjoying playing that with me, playing that lately. I played with a couple people who enjoy games but aren't as big into games as we are. And the first time we played it, they were like, all right, you have to bring that next time you come over, because we need to play again now that we know how to play.
Yeah, I agree with all of that about Above and Below. It's one of my favorites. The two things that stick out in my mind about that game is just the incredible, charming art style of that, which is carried through all of the Red Raven publisher. All of their games have that really unique art style, and it makes it so approachable and fun. And there's really nothing else out there in board gaming that mixes storytelling and strategy so well. It's both a worker placement game and a light adventure game. So it's just, that's a good one to get to the table. We need to play that again as a group pretty soon, I think.
It's a real fun game. I think one of my favorite parts about it is that you really get to enjoy your journey through the game. While it is a competitive game, there are very few ways in which you can screw people over. There are endgame scoring cards that everybody has the chance to buy, but you're rarely going to be going for the same one. And so it really is one of those games where you can play, you can enjoy the process of playing, and you can have some really awesome moments through encounters, but you're not going to get screwed over by the people you're playing with very often. And that just makes everyone have a lot more fun.
Yeah. We played, not too long ago, we played Above and Below's spiritual sequel, Near and Far. And I actually kind of still prefer Above and Below, because Near and Far is a much bigger game. It is about journeys and adventures. There's a town phase and a phase out on a world map, and there's a a legacy style component where you can kind of play multiple sessions. It's just a lot. It's a big game. It's more of a chore, I think, to get to the table and learn than Above and Below, which I'm going to talk about later, because actually I do think Above and Below, I think that's going to come up again in the episode, because I think it's a really good gateway game for various reasons.
Absolutely. I do have one question before we move on to our next section, though, Matt.
What's that?
Which Scooby-Doo character do you most identify with?
Oh, man. I mean, in my heart, like, I want to be Shaggy. I think I want to be that cool laid-back guy who's here to have fun and eat big sandwiches. But unfortunately, I think I'm the Fred of the group.
Oh, man.
Because I'm clearly, like, the best looking, and I'm wearing an ascot, like, even as we speak.
We're going to end on that answer, then. That works. All right. We'll be back in just a moment with a discussion on gateway board games.
All right, so welcome back to the Dice Pirates, our second episode here, and today's main topic is going to be gateway games. And so what do we mean by that? A gateway game is a great game to play to just kind of get into the hobby of board games. And when we talk about the hobby of board games, we're really talking about games sort of beyond that classic staple of family board games that we probably all grew up playing. Monopoly, Clue, Life, Risk. There's this kind of canon of like family games that everyone has a dusty copy of, missing some pieces somewhere in their house. But there's a world of board games out there that are deeper, more complex, more interesting, and it can be overwhelming if you're, you know, trying to get into the hobby. If you wander into your friendly local game store, or if you wander into the board game aisle of even a Target now has a lot of interesting new in different types of games, you don't really know where to start. And not every game is a good first choice. I mean, you don't want to bring a new player to the table with something like Twilight Imperium. It's just going to blow their mind with both the complexity and the length. So a gateway game is something that kind of, when somebody plays it, they're probably going to get hooked to the hobby. And so we thought this would be a good topic to tackle. Ian, what do you think, just to get us started, like, what are some qualities that make a good gateway game?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important aspects of a gateway game is sort of retraining somebody's image of what a board game is for them. Because like you said, a lot of people played, you know, Monopoly, they played Risk. These are the games that they know, they understand. And there's this idea of board gaming that they have in their mind. That, like, you go to play Risk, it's going to be a long, drawn-out affair. It's not going to be super fun. You're going to enjoy playing because you, you know, are with these people. And maybe you won't enjoy playing. Maybe they're going to go for Australia and they're going to crush you and you're just going to have a miserable time. So I think that's the idea, is like you have to sort of change their expectations for what they have when they go into a board game. So for me, I think the biggest thing are there's a couple different qualities you can have. You don't have to have every one of these, but I think you need to at least have one. So I think the first one for me is like, if you have a gateway game that has very simple mechanics, like it's very easy to understand, it's very simple to pick up and play, I think that's a really good one. There's a game that we really enjoy that I believe I put on my top five list called Splendor. I may not have, but Splendor is a very easy game to play. It's entirely dependent upon trying to purchase cards, and the way you purchase these cards is you choose from a selection of gems. In terms of ease to play, it's very easy. Each turn you either take a gem or you buy a card. That's all there is to it. And you can take two gems from the same pile, you can take three gems from different piles, and that's all there is to the game. It's easy to explain. You can explain it in 5 minutes, which is very rare for board games. Mm-hmm. And then you can play it, and it's fun, and you can play a game in 15 minutes.
That's really a good point, is games that are easy to grasp, but also easy to teach, I would say. There's really nothing worse than you got some people together to play a board game, and you're all sitting around the table, and now you've got to do that 20-25 minute teach where you run through all the actions and all the various components and all the sections. And some of these more complex games, the teach can go on for a long time. And when you see your friends or family's like eyes starting to glaze over while you're running through the rules, you know you've probably made a bad choice for an intro game. You know, if you're more experienced with the hobby, you know, kind of parsing out these rules isn't as overwhelming, but you just don't want to blow somebody's mind. And yeah, I think Splendor is a fantastic choice because it is simple to introduce and simple to pick up after a couple of turns.
Exactly.
I do think, so I agree with you. I think that easy to grasp games are, make a good gateway game. But I also put out that another quality that's kind of underappreciated is games that are still fun to play even if you lose. You know, let's face it, if you're new to a game, if you're new to the hobby, you're probably not going to win your first time out or do as well as you will in subsequent plays. And you want a game that the experience of playing it is still as fun. And that's, I think, an underappreciated quality. A game, to circle back to a topic here, to a game that we just talked about, I think that's one of the another reason why Above and Below really shines. And it's why I would recommend it right out the gate as my first gateway game. I think Above and Below, because it has a unique storytelling element where when you go on adventures, you open up this adventure book and the player to the left narrates for you some journey that you're on, some encounter in the caves, and you have to make a choice and you roll the dice. Something happens. I think it's still just fun to play, even if the actual worker placement side of Above and Below is not going great for you. Like if you're kind of new to that mechanic and you're not quite figuring that out, you can at least have fun on the adventures. You can win encounters and get treasure. And the random aspect of the adventures actually makes Above and Below kind of newcomer friendly in a way, because somebody who knows what they're doing could just have bad luck and they're not getting what they need on their journeys, whereas you might luck out and score big on some rolls and get some treasure and get ahead. So it can I think that really makes Above and Below a good choice as a gateway game. Easy to grasp, relatively easy to grasp, but also fun to play even if you're not doing that great.
You've actually completely convinced me. I was coming to this and I actually put Above and Below down as a game that I don't think you should recommend for a first-time player. The reason I said that was just because I feel like there is a certain amount of density to the mechanics. Like, it's not a lot, but if you're trying to teach people, it can get a little bit overwhelming before you start playing. Once you start playing, you get the idea. But I think you're right. Like, there is an aspect of newcomer friendliness. Things can happen. You just enjoy the process of playing. The first time we played with my other friends, one of the guys we played with who really doesn't play board games all that often ended up winning by a landslide, because he just got some absolutely amazing finds. He had some great runs through the underground that he was able to get some really fun encounters with, and it worked out really well for him, and he had a blast because he got those rolls and he was enjoying the process of adventuring time after time. So, and I think you're right. You've convinced me on this one.
Well, I'm glad I made a compelling case. I knew I'd bring you to the right side eventually on this dispute. But no, the other thing about Above and Below, that I think you're right, there is some rule complexity that might make it a little bit intimidating. So there is, in calling it a gateway game, I will say there's an asterisk. I think you do have to be careful as like a teacher and introducing it to somebody to kind of explain things like the way the scoring works at the end of the game, because you're getting points from various things. Gosh, it's been a while since I played it, but there's a track about the rarity of the goods that you get that has something. I'm confused about it now, even trying to recall it. There's a few things about the game that are a little complicated, but I think the thing that makes it work, even if somebody is new and they're kind of confused on some parts of it, I think the charming visuals and the adventure side of it make it pretty accessible. And it's a game that really breaks the mold. If somebody's coming to that game like from standard issue family board games, this will feel like a whole new world. And that's what's so exciting about it to me as a gateway game. So, what are some other qualities of gateway games, Ian, to you that make them a good choice as a gateway game?
Yeah, so I'm gonna pick up on the last thing you said there, the idea that there's a lot of confusion in how to score Above and Below. Like, not so much confusion, but it gets very complex. And I think another big aspect for me in a gateway game would be understanding the gameplay loop that you need to follow. And what I mean by that is, every game has an endpoint. This is how you win the game. This is what you need to do every game. And when you drop somebody in, it's really tough sometimes. Like, when we played Clans of Caledonia, I understood what I was trying to do. I was trying to score points. But I had no idea how to do that. It was so much going on. There was the goods track that I had to keep track of. I had to expand factories. I had to plant fields, and I had to get cows. And I didn't know where to begin. I had no idea, even having played lots of games. And so it took my first game to really come to grip with the way that the game should be played. So I'm going to talk about viticulture. Because I think when you sit somebody down, you say, okay, we're playing viticulture, you're growing grapes, and you're trying to sell wine. And somebody says, oh, okay. And then you can explain everything else about it. And there are, you know, a bunch of different actions you can take. While it's not the most complex game, there are still a lot of different things you can do, and there's a lot of strategy and choosing when you go, turn order, stuff like that. But the core idea of, okay, I'm going to plant fields, I'm going to harvest fields, I'm going to make wine, and I'm going to sell wine. That is a very easy to comprehend idea, even for somebody who kind of, if they just glaze over during the rule reading, if they're like, I didn't pay attention to anything at all, they're still going to figure it out.
Well, I think that there's probably, I think there's a good point to in that, where games that their theme makes sense, and so you kind of feel like the choices that you make are logical, can be good gateway games. And I think Viticulture could be the right choice for some people, but I will say that Viticulture is a more dense game, I think, than it seems at first glance, just because it is, there's a lot of actions available for you to choose. You know, it's a worker placement game. On your turn, you place your workers out on these locations onto the field, and it's divided into seasons. So there's a spring and a fall. And if you're not familiar with the worker placement mechanic at all, you've never played it. And a lot of people aren't, because it's not a common type of mechanic in traditional family games. You can, I think somebody could easily get overwhelmed by Viticulture. I do think there's, Viticulture is a fun game. I think it could be the right gateway game for some people, but I do think there's a high burden there on the teacher on bringing that to the table with the right context to make sure that you people are kind of grasping what worker placement is, how it works, and the flow between the two seasons, so that it makes sense to plan and leave some workers for the winter. I don't know. There's a lot going on there. I think it's probably not one that I would use as a gateway game, but I can see it being the one that clicks for some people and makes them love the hobby. Because the other thing it has going for it is just this incredible, like, visual presentation. It looks so amazing and, like, spread out on the table. And it's one of those games that is just really sophisticated and fun. It feels kind of elevated. It feels like a highbrow sort of board game experience.
Yeah, you have to get some wine, get some cheese out, have to make a night of it, act very posh while you're playing the game. I do agree, though. I do think you're right. There is a certain complexity to it. I think there might be sort of tiers of gateway games. And I understand we're talking about gateway games, so maybe that feels weird. But understanding who you're selling the game to is important. If you're talking about people that just don't play games at all, you have to understand that it needs to be far more simple. But if you are talking to people who are more willing to sit down, if they're willing to tolerate you for a couple hours and have you explain the rules to them, then I think there are more options for you to look at.
Well, I think that's actually a good point that you touched on. It was going to be one of the here on my notes. One of the things I wanted to mention is that not all gateway games are going to be created equal. I think some games are better suited for a particular audience. So I think if you know your friends and what their experiences are in maybe playing video games or computer games, might inform like how heavy a game you can bring to the table as the so-called gateway game. If somebody has played a lot of computer strategy games, Civilization or something like that, or City Skyline or something, if they're sort of used to the idea of like managing resources and thinking long-term about objectives, then Viticulture probably is not that big a deal. But if somebody doesn't play a lot of computer games or board games and is just kind of like trying to figure out the hobby, Viticulture might be a little heavier. But that's something for us, I think, as board game enthusiasts trying to grow the hobby, is really like know your audience and try to tailor your game choices to what you think is appropriate for their experience level and also their interests.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think there's also an aspect to where, what if you're somebody who doesn't play games trying to get into the idea of playing games, so you don't even have that basis to fall back on? Because I think that's another aspect to look at. What would be a game that is not only like easy to pick up, like easy to learn, but also might be necessarily kind of cheap because you don't want to have to invest a lot of money into something you might not enjoy?
Yeah, that's another factor in this that I wanted to touch on, is inexpensiveness as a factor in gateway games. Because you're right, I mean, the board gaming hobby can be cost prohibitive. I mean, a major big box game with a ton of miniatures could easily be over $100, and that's a huge investment if you're just trying to dip your toe into like gaming. And so I was kind of racking my brain for some low cost of entry options, and I realized Star Realms, I think, is a really fantastic gateway game for people. If you're not familiar with Star Realms, it's from White Wizard Games, and it is a simple deck-building game about building up a fleet of spaceships. And, you know, the deck building mechanic is, of course, a venerable mechanic now in gaming that came to us from Dominion. But basically, you draw a hand of cards at the start of the game that give you the ability to buy more cards or attack your opponent. And over time, you'll acquire better cards into your deck and increase your capability to deal damage. In this particular game, you're buying ships that can deal attacks or and then combo together off other ships in interesting ways. But, you know, again, deck building is one of these mechanics, kind of like worker placement, that somebody coming into the hobby has probably never seen before. So you need to kind of ease them into that in an easy to grasp way. And Star Realms is very simple to grasp. Once you kind of run through a couple of rounds of buying new ships into your hand, shuffling your deck, and then drawing more cards to make your new hand, you kind of realize how this is going to work. And it's really the Star Realms is really the perfect example of a game that's like easy to learn and like difficult to master, because it takes maybe 10 minutes to kind of understand the basic gameplay loop, but you can play hundreds of rounds of Star Realms and still be figuring out new strategies for the way cards interact. I mean, there's a still like a robust competitive scene around that game, and with especially with the online app version. But to the larger point that we brought up just moments ago is Star Realms is like maybe $12-$15 on Amazon.
It's just a pack of cards.
It's just a deck of cards. That's why I think it's a better choice than Dominion, because Dominion's still a boxed game with lots of cards. You know, it's going to run you definitely more than 20, if not 30, 40 bucks new. I think if you just want to like dip your toes into hobby board games for less than 20 bucks, you could do a lot worse than Star Realms.
Yeah, and I think Star Realms succeeds for a beginner game in the ways that Dominion doesn't, as you were saying. Like, there is a certain ease of understanding there where you can just say, okay, I understand the idea of Star Realms because I'm attacking this person. I need to get things that have big numbers. And even if that's not necessarily the optimal strategy, you can play with that and you can enjoy it and you can understand the way to do that.
Yeah, we played a game, we played a hand of Star Realms actually just a couple weeks ago after we recorded our first episode, and that's the first time that I'd picked it up in months. It was an early, it was truly a gateway game for me into the hobby, and played it a lot a few years ago, but hadn't touched it in ages, and dropped the cards down on the table and really relearned the game in about 5 minutes.
And we had a real tense session.
And we had a really tense, like, fun session of it. It's also, like, short to play, which is another kind of underrated aspect of gateway games. I think you need to pick a game that is kind of manageable in length. A lot of hobby board games can run well over 2 hours. It's not unusual for some of these games to be kind of epic in length. That can be a little intimidating if somebody's trying to dip their toe into the hobby. So you do need something that kind of plays quick and leaves them wanting more. I think Star Realms really does that.
I brought up Sushigo during our top five games, and I think this fits perfectly into that as well, because it's very easy. It's a card drafting game. You try to score the most points as they go around. You have a hand, take one card, pass that on. Super easy to explain to people. And if you get the party box, it will explain to you how the points are scored on the board in front of you, where you're going to score points. And as we were talking before, cost, very cheap. You can get the small pack version, which just has one menu. You can get the box version. Each of those is still very cheap. It's not expensive. It's way easier than a lot of these board games that have modeled pieces and minis. And while those are amazing to use, I think a lot of the cheaper ways to get into the game are probably card games, because those do tend to be easier to produce.
Yeah, absolutely. That brings me to kind of the next quality of board games that I think is worth considering is theme and storytelling. That's something that I think really separates traditional like family games from these hobby board games, is the ability of these really well-defined games to take you to a new place or create a scenario that is just really compelling and like pulls you in. And so I really kind of played around with various games that I feel like tell a story really well and or have a really compelling theme. And I arrived at one that kind of surprised me. It's a game that we haven't played in a long time. I actually think I let somebody borrow my copy and it never returned. Mm. But it's a game called Forbidden Island from Game Right. And this ticks a couple of boxes for me as a gateway game. It's inexpensive. This is a fairly older game, or at least it's been out for several years, and it's still in print, but there have been a couple of sequels or other
spin-offs,
more, spin-offs of this. Forbidden Desert, and I think Forbidden Skies is the most recent one. Because of that, you can actually pick up Forbidden Island now pretty cheap in most places. And Forbidden Island is still a really compelling game. If you're not familiar with it, it's a cooperative game in which you all play explorers trying to find four treasures that are hidden on an island. The catch is that the island is slowly sinking around you. You build your playing surface out of little cards that are kind of like the cardboard cards in a game of memory. And as the island floods, you flip them over to a flooded side, and you can take an action on your turn to try to shore them up and keep it from sinking. But if you don't, they will subsequently sink. And so the island is getting smaller and smaller around you. It's getting more frantic. You all play different roles. You have different powers. Like somebody can be like a diver or an engineer. It's been a while since I played it, so some of the particular roles are kind of blanking in my mind. But I don't know if I would say that the game like tells a story, but it has a really like rich theme. Like you feel like the urgency of like, oh man, this island is sinking. We got to get these treasures. It's also cooperative. I think that's another element to consider when you're bringing to the table a gateway game. Is a cooperative game is a great way for there to be no pressure about having to like learn all the rules and be competitive. If somebody's new, they can just sit down and you can walk them through some of their choices on their turn, because we're all working together and we're all going to win together. So cooperative, and also cooperative games are, again, not something that people probably are familiar with if they didn't, if you're coming in new to the hobby. Most people didn't grow up playing like co-op style board games. And so it can be a really fresh, fun experience, and really recommend Forbidden Island.
Yeah, I think having a game where there isn't a lot of direct competition and potentially even cooperation is a very good way to get people into the idea of gaming as well, because there is a lot of frustration and tension that can come with playing people when you're going competitively, especially if you know more about games than they do, because you're either trying to hold yourself back or you're just going to crush them if it's a very competitive game, which is why a lot of people don't enjoy board games, because you play a game like Monopoly and the guy who understands that Boardwalk's not the best option is going to crush you. Because that's just the way it works. So
I always get Boardwalk. What do you mean Boardwalk's not the best option?
That's why you've lost every time. That's why you don't like that game.
You know, that's fair. I don't know if I ever won Monopoly. I hate Monopoly.
We figured it out.
I was going to bring up Monopoly as an example of a game that does almost everything wrong. And, I mean, we don't have to harp on Monopoly. I think people that are serious about board games know that Monopoly is just a disaster in most cases. It's the roll-to-move mechanic makes the game frustrating. It's too long, and it's cutthroat by nature. But it's interesting to talk about Monopoly in this context, because people that say they don't like board games or people that like dread the idea of a game night probably have in their past a terrible memory of a game of Monopoly where somebody got upset and flipped the table or just seemed to like drag on for 1,000 years and the whole family hated it at the end. Monopoly is a game that has probably ruined more people like for board gaming than anything else. And that's an example of a game that's not a gateway game.
Monopoly is utterly soul-crushing. I have a quick fact about that game, actually.
Oh, I love it. Monopoly facts, go.
So the original creator of Monopoly actually had two rule sets for the game. There was the rule set that she believed the game should have, and then there was the rule set that was actually designed to explain the downfalls of pure capitalism. And when the game was actually stolen by the Parker brothers, the person who designed it was... I think they paid maybe $100 tops for the game, if paid at all.
Wow.
The Parker brothers actually used the rule set that she did not like, that was designed to show why it was bad, and that is the rule set we now have today. So, fascinatingly enough, the rule set everybody knows is the one that was designed to be terrible.
So, a game about the evils of capitalism was itself kind of brought to us through the cold-hearted evils of capitalism.
Truly ironic. But I do... Getting back on topic for a second, I do think there is an aspect of cooperation, which is why, I know we talked about it beforehand, but I want to say that Betrayal at the House on the Hill is a really good beginner board game as well. Now, I think any of the games within this family are a good way to start. Betrayal at the House on the Hill is probably the cheapest, since it's the oldest one. The one with Scooby-Doo, there was a Baldur's Gate, I think they might be making another one as well. Those games are cooperative. And they really are truly cooperative. First, you're trying to explore, you're trying to find weapons and level ups to make you more powerful, and that's all very easy to understand, and you get to do it together, and you get to strategize where you're going. But I think more so than that, it provides you that twist at the end. Now, we talked about Dead of Winter last podcast as well. Mm-hmm. And that had a cooperative aspect to it, but you had one person who was a traitor. And I think the difference is, besides, of course, the density of mechanics, is that in Dead of Winter, the person who's a traitor knows that they're a traitor the whole time. When you play Betrayal, everybody is working together. They're working together the whole time until you get to the twist. And when the twist happens, somebody will maybe get bit by a vampire, or all of a sudden they become a zombie, and then that one person gets to become the bad guy. And so you're working together this whole time, and that one person gets to be on the other team. They didn't know they were going to be before. So there wasn't some long-term strategy. There wasn't that feeling of, like, I never got to really do my goals. I never got to actually, like, frustrate their designs. You were working with them until you got to go against them. And so there's a really fun twist that turns there, which is not purely cooperative, but it's not competitive in the way that makes it frustrating, because it's such a final part to the game.
So Betrayal is a game that I was waffling on introducing as a gateway game. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I think there's a couple of points to talk about here that are interesting. I like Betrayal. It can be very fun. When it works, it really is one of the more fun experiences you can have around the table, because it tells kind of a procedurally generated story every time. To elaborate a little more on how the game works, and I know a lot of people listening might be familiar with it, but it's basically... In the first phase of the game, you're exploring a haunted house, and when you walk through a room, you draw from a stack of tiles that's like the next room of the house, and when you move into that room, some crazy encounter might happen. There's a spooky skeleton in the closet, or you might find an item, or you might have something called an omen. And when you find an omen, you make a haunt roll. And over the time, as you keep finding omens, at some point you're going to fail this haunt roll. And it triggers a second phase of the game called The Haunt. And when that happens, you open up a book, literally open up this huge book of scenarios that comes with the game. And depending on which room you're in and which item triggered it, you proceed into an end game that totally changes the rules in any number of ways. And like Ian was saying, it could be you could all of a sudden be a vampire story, or there could be demons or aliens, or you've been transported to another dimension. There's all kinds of wild stories. Those weird plot twists and B-movie elements are what made the game so memorable and fun. But the game is sort of notorious that it can actually be broken. You can end up with a end game where the character who's the villain is just super overpowered, because in the first part of the game they found the blood dagger, this like really overpowered weapon. Or you can end up in a game where the villain has no chance of winning because all the heroes are overpowered, or the layout of the board is just not favorable to the villain. It's because the game is randomly generated every time, it can break, and it can actually be kind of miserable. I've had some really bad experiences with that game, and we have at least one friend in our playgroup who just will not play Betrayal ever again.
This is why I think that Betrayal at Baldur's Gate is actually a superior game than Betrayal at House on the Hill, because they remove that mechanic. Well, they don't remove it, they mitigate the mechanic. So instead of making a haunt roll every single time you find an omen, they make it so that your haunt roll cannot succeed until you've hit six omens found. So it delays the game, so it makes it so that if the twist happens early on, like you said, in House of the Hill, you can just be absolutely out of luck. But in Baldur's Gate, it gives you time. Everybody is able to find items. Everybody is a little bit more leveled up. And it really levels the playing field so that the end game is a lot more enjoyable for everybody involved.
That's really interesting. We got to play that one, because I'm kind of curious to see how that feels. I would say... going back to the point about kind of knowing your audience, I would say Betrayal at House on the Hill is the perfect gateway game, obviously, for anybody that likes horror movies or spooky stuff. It's also, I think, setting the right tone when you get that game to the table is important. People kind of need to know that this is sort of for laughs. It's a perfect kind of like pizza and pretzels type game. You know, we're all just hanging out. We're all having laughs. Maybe there's a cheesy horror movie on TV in the background. And it's not really meant to be like a game that's super competitive or has a definitive winner. But if it's just kind of one of those games that's sort of like a, you know, the glue that holds together a hangout time, I think it's perfect. So that's where I think as a host, and this might be a fun topic for a future episode, is like hosting a game night and how you think through that to make sure everybody has a good time. Like as a host, you bring a game like Betrayal out and you kind of present it as like, this is just a silly B-movie. Encourage everybody to do funny voices and have a good time with it, and don't really expect it to be like this tight competitive game.
Yeah, this is where we talk about hosting a game. I'd actually like to bring up a game called Scotland Yard.
Okay.
You may have heard of other games such as like Nuns on the Run. These are an idea of one versus many games, where one person is playing against however many other people there are. A lot of these games often scale up more than most games. You can have maybe two people on the other side, up to like six or seven. And Scotland Yard is a game about one person working as the criminal who's trying to escape, and the rest of them are detectives that are trying to find this person. And the game is essentially a map of London, where you have bus routes, you have metro routes, and you have taxi routes, stuff like that. So there's lots like a very small movements you can make. There are medium movements, there are long movements you can make. And the way that the game works is the criminal who's moving along has his token hidden from the rest of the detectives. They do not know where he is. They know where he starts, and every four turns or so, he will show up. And he has to show how he got there. So if he takes a bus, he has to say he takes a bus. If he takes the metro, he has to say he takes the metro. So you can work out an approximation of where he is, and you can say, okay, he's either here, here, or here. And I think this is a good game to start if the person hosting is willing to play that one and is able to explain it, because it gives you the ability to control the game a lot. Because everybody gets to work together. There's no idea of like, I have to figure this out on my own. Everybody is working together, really coming up with ideas. Like, oh no, I think he's here because that would have been smart. And then also there's the idea of like, if you can tell people are getting frustrated, fall into their trap. You can make it easier for them on the fly if you want to, because they don't know where you're moving. They don't know your mindset. And you can make the game more enjoyable for them as like you play. So I think that's another interesting game to look at, because it does give the host a lot of control over the flow of the game.
That's a really interesting choice, and I would not have thought about that as a gateway game. But you do kind of raise a good point that if the host plays the villain or the criminal that's on the run, it puts maybe some of the new players working with other players in a cooperative way, and so that takes some of the pressure off of maybe being overwhelmed by it. And it's also an interesting choice as a gateway game, because it's a hidden role, hidden movement game. And again, that's something that's kind of unusual, something maybe someone's never seen before. If they're coming in and they're not, it'd be a different type of board game experience, and it would really kind of show a new player like the possibilities of what the hobby has to hold. It's also very important when you play this game, and I can't overstate how important this is. When you play it, you must use a British accent at all times when communicating. That's mandatory.
I know that you think it is.
Yes.
We all had to deal with that the last time we played the game. There's a reason it hasn't showed up to the table again.
Yes, I am Lieutenant Daniel Welbylove of Scotland Yard.
And there it is.
Yes.
Well, we do love this game. This is a really fun game, and I would recommend it. I think it succeeds for the same reason that Dungeons & Dragons works when you have a really good dungeon master. Because he can make the game fun for everybody just by, you know, manipulating things to make sure everybody has a good time.
Be honest, have we never played that game again because of the British accents?
No. I mean, no, we have not played it.
His eyes are like, full of deceit.
I'm backpedaling full step right now.
I've never been more hurt. Also, if we play it again, I will still use the British accent.
I would expect nothing less from you.
Cheerio!
We're going to say cheerio to that topic real quick. I do think that no discussion of gateway games would be complete without talking about games like Settlers of Catan, which at this point is basically up there with Monopoly and Risk. Like, almost everybody owns Settlers of Catan. When my wife and I got married, we got three copies of Settlers of Catan as wedding gifts, and so we were giving them away for Christmas gifts for the next couple of years just because we had too many of them.
You didn't give me one.
I didn't think you'd want it.
That's fair. No, Catan is a great gateway game. I mean, it really is. But I almost wondered, is it like truly a gateway into hobby board gaming? Because now it's almost so ubiquitous. It's almost like right alongside Monopoly as a game that most people are going to have. So I was thinking, like, when you think about gateway, like, what's going to kind of take you beyond classic family games and get you a little bit deeper into gaming publishers and stuff that you've maybe never seen before? But Catan really does kind of introduce the basic mechanics of, like, is it Catan or Catan? Let's go ahead and have that discussion right now. Catan or Catan?
I've always said, what did I say earlier? Because I think I say Catan.
I think you said Catan, and then I just said Catan, and that may be a game about SNL's Chris Catan, but I'm not sure.
I'm not 100% sure. I'm pretty sure that the game was German, if I'm correct.
Okay.
Because Germany actually had a very large board game scene.
I'm going to Google it. Large.
You used to look it up right now.
I'm gonna look it up because we'll see.
Fun fact about Settlers of Catan, while we look back on it now and we say, okay, it's a fairly simple game, when he was designing it, he actually thought that the game was far too complex for people back then, and he was worried that it would not pick up traction because there were so many rules to it.
It was first published in Germany in 1995 Frank Cosmos Verlag as Die Settler von Catan.
There we go.
Die Settler von Catan. You know, I'm going to stop trying to pronounce German words because it could borderline become offensive at some point.
Especially because Germany is, in many ways, the king of board games.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, the games that we call Euro games are also often called German-style games for a reason. Yeah, this is, I think Catan is a really, really good way for somebody to experience like strategy gaming, a little bit deeper gameplay. But Catan also falls victim to that monopoly thing of it can be really frustrating because of the dice. Mm-hmm. I've had games of Catan that just were just brutally unfun because I could not get the resources I need. I'm just rolling the dice on my turn and it's never coming up that any of my spaces are producing, and it just stinks. Or I'm trying to trade and nobody's trading with me because it's getting into the end game. It's getting a little more cutthroat. That game, it can be one of those ones that actually like ruins people of the game, right? Because somebody just puts the thief down on your space and it screws you. Or, yeah, you know, it's got that cutthroat thing that I worry can actually put people off of games.
Yeah, I think it's very feast or famine, and I think you're right. Like, I don't know that I would use it as a gateway game because you can have those issues. And while I think a lot of people know it, so it's good to bring up because people may have familiarity with it, if you're looking to get people further into hobby board gaming, I think it might be a bad choice. We did play, my wife and I have played a lot, especially over, you know, the quarantine together. We played Catan. There's a dice game of Catan. I think it's called Catan.
I've seen that.
Roll. I apologize. I don't have the exact name in my head, but the idea is basically it turns Catan into a Yahtzee game. And so you roll your dice, on the dice are the various resources that you need. You get to choose which resources you want to keep. And just like Yahtzee, you roll three times, you keep whichever resources you want through the rolls, and then you get to build what you want. And so you get to progress through the game. It keeps the game to a defined length, so it will never go over, like, I think the longest game we had was like, it never goes longer than 5 to 10 minutes, just because you roll, you build your thing, and then you move on. So it's a very simple game. Just Catan Dice Game is all it's called.
Yeah, I just looked that up on Amazon. It looks like it's just called Catan Dice Game.
Yeah.
I would be interested to play that, actually, just because it is kind of a fun, quick-to-play variant on the Catan formula. Let's keep saying it both ways and confuse everyone. I think that would be fun.
But yeah, so I think that that's a fun way to do it. Catan is definitely an interesting game. In that regard, just because it did, in many ways, kick off the board game renaissance, but it does struggle from the same issues that a lot of those older games had.
Yeah, you can't have a discussion of gateway games without touching on it, because it probably, for a lot of people, probably is the gateway game that got them into the hobby. I just think there's probably better options out there to introduce somebody to. I would much rather play Above and Below, probably, than Catan most days. Just because there's story, there's... it's just more intriguing overall, and it's just less frustrating and less cutthroat.
I think that's a good point, yeah.
So I want to talk about the final game that I would consider a gateway game. And this was going to be an odd choice, I think, for a lot of people. But it's a game called Runebound, specifically Runebound third Edition from Fantasy Flight Games. And that might be an odd choice to some people's eye as a gateway game, because it's a big game. It's rules heavy. It's a fantasy adventure board game where you play various kind of archetypical fantasy heroes, wizards, warriors, dwarves, a cat lady, and you are trying to stop some terrible calamitous evil from destroying the land. There's two scenarios that come packed in the base box, a dragon and then one involving an undead lich king who's causing zombies to pop up over the map. And all the heroes are racing against time to gear up, level up, and be able to confront the villain before the land is destroyed. Like I said, it's, to be perfectly frank, it's pretty complex. It's got a lot of cards. It's got a lot of rules. But here's why I want to make an argument that it's a good gateway game. One, it was my gateway game. When I was first trying to think about getting into the hobby, have been listening to podcasts like The Adventure Zone, where people were doing role-playing, and wasn't quite ready to get into D&D, didn't know anybody playing Dungeons & Dragons, I started Googling board games that might be have a similar experience or feel, and stumbled upon this, ordered it, played it with some friends, and completely changed the course of, like, I won't say my life. That sounds too dramatic. But it totally introduced me to the world of games. It really worked for me. Also, I've played it with a number of people over the years who really don't play a lot of board games, aren't into the hobby at all, and they've all really, really loved it. I think it's underrated, and I think it's underrated for two reasons. It's got a really compelling sense of urgency that pulls you in. It's a race against time. The game has a finite number of turns. It plays out over a couple of acts. If you don't defeat the boss by the end of the second act, the game, you lose. And so there's a real compelling, like, it doesn't necessarily tell a cohesive story, but that sense of urgency invades the game, where you are trying to complete quests, level up your hero, and get ready for the end encounter. And it really does pull you in. The other thing that helps is the rhythm of the game is very similar to video games like Skyrim, or maybe even like Zelda, where you are completing quests, completing objectives around the map, and getting rewarded in the form of like new gear or new abilities. And that kind of gameplay loop of like getting more powerful over time is something that a lot of people who have played those type of games can wrap their mind around really quickly. So even though the game has a lot of rules, it makes sense to you if you're coming into it. So that would be my asterisk. I think it's a gateway game for people who have maybe played a lot of video games and haven't ever had that experience translated to the tabletop. I think they would pick it up pretty quickly. I know we've played this game together a few times. What do you think about Runebound as a gateway game?
So this is actually really interesting, because when I was coming up with my ideas for this discussion, there were a couple games that I put down that I thought were not good examples of beginner board games. Dune was one of those, because you would never introduce that to somebody who was new at board games, because that would be a terrible idea. They would never play a board game again.
It's too complex, too heavy.
Runebound was another one of those games that I chose. I chose it because I felt that there was too much density of mechanics to it. Like, I understand the idea. Like, I think you make a good point that if you're trying to get somebody in who has played those certain kinds of games before, if they already have kind of a basic idea of the leveling up system, then they can get the hang of it. But I think if you are looking to get somebody who may have just played games like Monopoly or Risk before and enjoyed those, if you're trying to get them into Runebound, they're probably going to be really intimidated by the game, because you get dropped onto the world map, and there is a time limit that you have. You have to complete certain things, and you only have so long before the end happens. And it's very wide open at that point. There's nothing saying you need to go here or you need to go here. There are a lot of places you can go, but how do you decide? And so I think for me, like, I definitely agree with the asterisk on this. It's a great game, and I do think if you find the right people to start with it, but if you have people who are just getting into gaming in general, I think it's one of those games that would just be a little bit too much.
So I think you raise some really good points, and I agree. The game is rules heavy, and it can be really complicated. But the only thing I have sort of as a counter argument is my own experience with it. I've sat down and taught that game to people that I know have never played role-playing games or very complex board games, and they picked it up pretty quickly. It's not necessarily a game that you're going to completely grasp the first time you play it, but it's a game that I think you're going to have fun playing, because no matter where you go or what you do on the board, you're going to have an interesting encounter. To kind of elaborate on it a little, the game board is this really kind of beautifully rendered map of a fantasy land, kind of a generic land of elves and wizards and magic and all that jazz. And all around the map, there are these little tokens that you can land on and have an adventure. And they're color-coded for either quests or combat or just encounters, like you're just going to run into somebody. And you draw, when you land on one of these spaces, you draw a card from the corresponding deck and then resolve what happens. So maybe you meet a mysterious stranger at the crossroads and they give you a choice you have to make, or somebody gives you an item to deliver on another point of the map. It is kind of an open-ended game. It's a little directionless, but really wherever you go, you're going to have some interesting encounter, some interesting choice to make. And then when you resolve it, you're going to get a reward, either gold or an item. So even if you're not necessarily doing well the first time you play it, you're going to be doing something. Your character is going to be gaining progress, getting new weapons, getting new abilities. That, I think, makes it fun. That goes back to something we talked about earlier, is like you want games I think you want the gateway game experience to be something that's just fun to play, even if you lose. You may not win Runebound the first time you play it. It's hard to like level up and beat the dragon. It's a tall mountain to climb. But you are gonna have some victories. You're gonna defeat some monsters. You're gonna complete a quest. You're gonna trick your character out with a cool new bow or a sword or something, and that feels good. That feels like you're accomplishing something. And so I don't know. People that I've played it with have all always really liked it. I think it's a super underrated game. I don't know. Maybe I love it more disproportionately than most people do because I just love fantasy stuff so dang much. But I think it's a game that maybe didn't get its due. It's out of print now, but it did get a few expansions. If you can find a copy for cheap, I think it's worth a look.
I mean, I definitely see the argument you have there. I think if anybody is single-handedly going to bring Rune Mound back into relevance, it's going to be you for sure.
Sure. I'd like you to join my campaign, Runebound 2020. It's a campaign to get Fantasy Flight to put out a fourth edition. There's going to be a change.org petition that I'm starting. I'm not doing any of these things, just for the record, but I do think it's a great game. I don't think it got its due. It's a classic one in my mind. I know it's not without its flaws, and it's probably not for everybody.
Still a very fun game, though. You actually already answered the question I was going to ask, which was, what was your introduction to the board game hobby? You said Runebound. But I wanted to, really, the final game I wanted to put out there is Carcassonne, which was my original introduction to the board game hobby. Carcassonne is another Euro game. It is a worker placement game with the added twist that as you put your workers down, you're actually building the map. The game consists of a bunch of different tiles, and you put the tiles down, and as you put a tile down, you are allowed to put a worker onto the tile that you placed. And you can do things, you can claim cities, you can start building roads, all of these sort of things, and you begin to get your workers back as cities that you've started get completed, as roads get completed, things like that. And that's one of those games where, because of the way the game works in which you're building the map as you go, it's easy to teach somebody the base mechanics and then explain the more in-depth sort of nuances to the game as you go, because you don't have to explain everything from the beginning. All you have to do is explain the basic concept and what they need to do with the single tile that they have in front of them, and then as they move forward, as they take more tiles, they're going to understand what happens. So it's a good way to sort of ease people into it and sort of really trickle in the rules instead of throwing them all at once.
You know, I thought this was an interesting choice as a gateway game, and I sort of see the argument because it's not the most complex game in the world by any stretch of the imagination. It doesn't have a lot of components. It's not overwhelming to look at. It's also just a classic game that's been around for a long time for a reason, and it's got that like different quality. Like it's not a traditional board game where the board folds out and you all get a piece. You know, it's very different. I think it is a good introduction into different types of games. But my argument against it is that I've only played that game once, despite the fact that it's a classic. You and I have played that game one time together, and I felt lost. I didn't get it. I don't think it's a super intuitive game for everybody. Maybe I just have bad, like, spatial reasoning skills. But I could not figure out how to create my little, like, enclosed spaces and score. Or maybe it's just because it's a little bit abstract, and I wanted it to have more, I don't know, story or something. Like, you look at the cover and you think, like, this is going to be this fun medieval strategy game, and it's basically like, it's a game about roads and little wooden people. I don't know. It just, that game did not make me, like, didn't, like, spark my imagination the way some other games do. And maybe that's just one of those things where people kind of want different things out of games. You know, something like Runebound or Above and Below or Betrayal, some of the other games we talked about today that have more narrative kind of pull. Those are the things that kind of draw me in versus a Catan or a Carcassonne, which is an interesting puzzle to solve, but there's not really that story hook there.
Yeah, I think there definitely are aspects to where if you're more into strategy, there are different kinds of games you would like. But that's definitely a game I wanted to put out there. That was my introduction. I still love playing that game. Maybe it's not as complex. There is definitely games that I think are better, but I do think that's a good game to start out with. But
I agree too, and it also hits on another point that we brought up earlier, is that it's a pretty inexpensive game. I mean, it's been out a long time now. It's easy to get a copy. If you want a kind of a low cost of entry, easy to pick up and play game, you could probably do a lot worse than Carcassonne.
Yeah. So we've thrown a lot of games out, and I think we've had a pretty good idea of what we consider an entry board game. What sort of board games there are. Do you have any closing thoughts?
I would say, like, my only kind of final recommendation would be if you're starting to get interested in playing board games, you don't know where to go, you could do a lot worse than checking out Board Game Geek. Heading over to BoardGameGeek.com is kind of the hub of, like, board game hobby culture, and you can find great lists there of intro board games by theme, or just look at their top, 100 games and start getting some ideas of, like, what to play. And another thing that I would recommend for somebody trying to get into the hobby is check out Amazon and spend some time, like, checking out the reviews and seeing what people say about the game before you purchase. When I was thinking about buying a Dungeons & Dragons-like board game experience, there were a lot of options out there for that and a lot of potential choices to make. And I settled on Roombound after I spent hours and hours, like, reading reviews and trying to get a feel for, like, how the different games work and what people said about them. And so doing your homework, I think, is really important to make sure you get a good game that you're going to enjoy and want to keep playing.
So that's our discussion on beginner board games. We'd love to hear from you guys as well if you're listening to this. Definitely let us know, what was your entry into board gaming? What is one of your favorite games that you love to introduce to other people? Matt, where can people get in touch with us?
Sure. The best place to find us is actually going to be on Instagram at Dice Pirates. Come follow us there. We post regularly throughout the week about the games we're playing. We have, like, some reviews, sort of mini reviews in our post if you scroll back through. And, of course, you can keep track of the latest episodes of the podcast there. And send us a message. We'd love to hear from anyone listening about what you're playing and what your gateway game was.
Absolutely. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This has been the Dice Pirates. Leave us a review if you enjoyed us. Let us know what you think. And we'll be back next time.
See you soon.